You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Film historian J.E. Smythe is my guest, and she's the author of many books, including Fred Zinnemann and The Cinema of Resistance, Edna Ferber's Hollywood, American Fictions of Gender, Race, and History, and Reconstructing American Historical Cinema from Cimarron to Citizen Kane. I've read many film histories, but Professor Smythe's recent book, Nobody's Girl Friday, The Women Who Ran Hollywood, is one of the best, and I invited her to talk with us about it. J.E. Smythe, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. I'm glad to be here.
So your book kind of dispels the commonly held belief that women had no place behind the camera in the film industry during Hollywood's golden age.
Well, I try. I think that in the past 10 to 15 years, there's been a lot of work that's focused on the silent era and the work of Shelley Stamp and Jane Gaines and others. And, you know, there's been a lot of interest, I think, at the Criterion Collection and Kino Lorber, whatever, and raising awareness of women directors in the silent period. But there's this sense that you get in the university and like academia and definitely in popular history that women just sort of, you know, faded away as soon as the movie business started to make money. So it was okay for women to play around, you know, and be stunt women or write a few scripts or direct or produce early on when nobody knew where this was all going. But as soon as it became a big business, it consolidated after the First World War and the studios became big business entities. Women were, you know, pushed out and they became what you looked at rather than the creators of these films. And that is, to a certain extent, a huge myth and really, you know, the erasure of these women from the history of the studio era, the classical Hollywood period, is part of the reason that I wrote that book, because there were hundreds of women. They weren't just these sort of great, powerful, towering success stories, like, for example, Mary McCall or Barbara McLean or Betty Davis. There aren't these sort of exceptions to the rule. They're everywhere, and they were doing every single kind of job that you can think of within the film business.
You put it in percent. I mean, what would be the percentage of women involved in the film industry?
Well, I mean, this is the interesting thing. I was trying to tally it up and, you know, going through whatever remained of studio employment records. You know, obviously the income tax records would have been perfect, but they weren't available. And I found the press and the studios themselves were trumpeting this, you know, during the system. They weren't hiding it. They were really proud of it. And they actually advertised their business in the trade papers and in the national press as being ahead of the rest of the country in terms of, you know, equal representation and employment for women. So it was around 40%. That's a lot. And these weren't just secretaries, even though saying just a secretary is problematic, because, you know, you could start off, you know, getting coffee, taking dictation or whatever, but you could end up being Dorothy Arzner, Virginia Van Epp. You could be a producer, director, whatever. You didn't just stay in one spot. The business allowed you to rise if you were cut out for it.
How did you research all this?
I started in Boston and made my way all over the place. And so I was in Texas, Chicago, Wisconsin, Indiana, Wyoming, definitely California, New York, everywhere. And you do have pieces. You have individual papers sometimes that are left. You know, Betty Davis's papers are in Boston, of course. And then you have the 20th Century Fox papers, Daryl Zanuck's papers at the University of Southern California. They're everywhere. And it's about patching everything together. And I never would have been able to find as much as I did if I didn't have the help and friendship of so many archivists. I mean, they've been the stalwarts and with me ever since I started work. And I mean, Ned Comstock, I owe such a great debt to him. And I mean, so many scholars do. He's like the dean of film archivists. He knows absolutely everything. And he's just retired this past year. But just like you, he's a committed Maisie fan. I turned him into one. And, you know, this stuff is there. You can find it. That's the interesting thing. These studios were proud of the fact that they were, you know, good at bringing women up the ladder, the career ladder. It wasn't just a place where women were sexually harassed or their careers were torched if they got too important. they couldn't make it. There was a period. There was a period of about 20 years where this happened. And it was the height of the studio system. And you had people like Bob Thomas, who was a wonderful reporter and biographer for many years, really started his career by focusing on the huge numbers of women who were employed across the studios in a variety of professions, and really focusing on women like Joan Harrison, who worked with Hitchcock and then moved on into television, and Virginia Van Epp and others. So the material is there. You just have to look. But for some reason, for years and years, even though the archives were there, there were papers, there were scripts that had women's names on them, conferences where you could clearly see that women were involved in producing, or editors who were supervising the picture, all this material was there, but it was as if they were hidden in plain sight. Nobody wanted to see what was there, or they just glossed over it. They didn't, and because in a way, when you come to grips with this and you look at the range of jobs that were open to women, it dispels that biggest myth that the film business was just for big, bad, cigar-chomping, you know, moguls and director geniuses. And there was something else going on in there. And it's important to rediscover it, you know.
Yeah, well, I think one of the most important things that I feel from your book is the auteur theory, you know, which is it grew in popularity in the 50s and 60s, I guess, that the director is the author of his films. But your book kind of argues against auteur theory and gives so much credit to editors, and that these editors were largely women.
Yeah, there were. I mean, there were supervising editors who looked over, a bunch of a studio's output and could actually order directors to retake certain material. I mean, this is Barbara McLean at 20th Century Fox, who worked very closely with Zanuck, or Margaret Booth. They were everywhere. And I mean, the idea that directors, you know, control the cut, this is something that does gain, you know, prevalence, I think, in the 1960s, but this was also the period when the studio system itself was falling apart and had changed demonstrably, so that the whole concept of film production had moved more towards male helmers, a writer, director, or producer who hired guys he knew from other productions. And so the women who had belonged in the system, whether they were secretaries or executives or screenwriters or editors or whatever, they would have been a pool of talent in a certain studio, and they would have been on a roster, and they would have, you know, gotten the jobs as the productions came up. In the new system, when you move towards independence, you have fewer productions, and they are much more geared to the desires of one person. And guys tend to hire, you know, the other guys on the set to get a certain kind of vibe. And so you have, for example, women who, and you see it even in the Academy Awards, where there were a lot of women who were getting nominated for best screenplay, best editing, whatever, in the 1930s and 1940s. And then when you do have this shift, you see fewer and fewer women who are getting this kind of recognition. And it also is reflected in the overall the number of productions that are coming out. So
the era of the new Hollywood, as we call it,
Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, yeah.
that period, which was so, you know, liberal and forward thinking, was far less open to women contributing to the pictures.
Yeah, you do have a change that happens, I think, in the 1950s, where you have the studios allowing more and more of their talent goes independent. You have more acting talent, big superstars are forming their own production companies. You have things that are basically outsourced. You have contracts that aren't renewed. And you have, you know, a real problem with television. And then you also have, of course, the blacklist. And there were a disproportionate number of women in all levels of production who were blacklisted or graylisted during the late 1940s and 50s. But that's, again, you get this sense in the history of the blacklist that it's all about the Hollywood 10. It's all about the guys. But there were all kinds of women, from secretaries all the way up to really prominent writers and producers, whose careers tanked precisely because of the political intolerance of that era.
And so guys like Dalton Trumbo, who are the you know, the face of the blacklist, they actually triumphed because they came back and worked again or they continued to work with fronts and so on. But that wasn't the case with the women involved.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the more interesting women that I looked at was the president of the Screenwriters Guild, the first woman to be president of the Screenwriters Guild, Mary McCall Jr. And she worked at all of the studios, at Columbia, at MGM for a long time. She worked with Zanuck. They got along very well. And she was doing some of the bigger pictures. But she was a political moderate. And she was able to, for a while, I think, during the 1930s and 40s, to build a kind of political coalition with Democrats and Republicans who would actually talk to each other. And she was able to build a coalition of women. And she had, you know, quite a lot of examples in front of her with, like, for example, Frances Marion and Mary Pickford and the women of the 1920s who worked together in the industry to help build their careers. But she was much more on the left than Marion and then, for example, Jeannie McPherson or Bess Meredith or Mary Pickford, who were all Republicans. She was a diehard Roosevelt Democrat. She was head of all sorts of Democratic committees in Los Angeles and California, dined with Eleanor Roosevelt, was very close with the Roosevelt family. But she, you know, in spite of the fact she was a huge labor leader, she knew that she had to build a coalition. And for years when the Screenwriters Guild was basically outlawed, and they were trying to get a contract, they only really had a contract in force in 1942. She was the one that helped write it and build it. But she built it by making concerted efforts to create some kind of community in Hollywood that cut across political lines. And she was friends with Hedda Hopper. They used to go hat shopping together. I had no idea about this, but you know, they had that connection. And she also knew on which side her bread was buttered on, because if she ever had any dust-ups with the producers, she had both Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons on her side. They had her back because they both knew that she would do everything to ensure that women had a fair shake when it came to work with the Guild, but also across the industry as well, too, because she was chairman of the Hollywood Guilds and Unions. She ran all sorts of committees, everything from, you know, frankly, Over 40, which was an organization where, you know, women who were in the business weren't afraid to actually admit their age and say that they wanted more adult themes in motion pictures, you know, to Hollywood Mobilization and the Hollywood Writers Committees, Hollywood Democratic Committee. She was everywhere. And I think precisely because she was able to get away with so much with the producers early on and get the contract signed, she did make enemies. She was a moderate. She did not believe in, you know, a kind of polarized landscape in Hollywood and did her best to keep people together in the late 40s. But when she did actually fall from power in 1951-52, it was not necessarily because she was considered to be a communist. She wasn't. It was because she went after producers. And I think in a way, to answer your question about Dalton Trumbo, that was sort of one of the reasons why he was able to build a career later on in Hollywood and she wasn't, because she wasn't afraid to go toe-to-toe with the big boys and call them out. And she had a colleague, Paul Jericho, who she didn't really get along with politically. I think she liked his wife, Sylvia. Everybody tended to like Sylvia. He was a bit more difficult to deal with. But he had worked on a film at RKO Pictures for Howard Hughes' Las Vegas Story. And it was discovered he was a communist. And when Howard Hughes, who had bought RKO and basically cut it to shreds, you know, let so many staff go and ruined the studio, basically, when he found out, he fired the guy and basically didn't give him credit for the script that he had written. And this was in violation of the Screenwriters Guild agreement that she had helped write and, you know, back 10 years ago. And she went after him in the courts. And this was something basically, this was like crossing the line. This is basically what you did not do. And when she did that and basically said in, I think it was Frontiers Magazine, sort of generic California magazine. She said, you know, I hate communism, but that's not really the point. You know, Hughes hired Jericho, and however detestable his politics may be to anybody, we have an agreement which has to be enforced. And we have credit arbitration. The guy wrote the script and his name deserves to be up there. And that's that. And unfortunately, the California court sided with Hughes. And when that happened, the guild contract, the one that took years to get agreed upon, the one that costs so much for screenwriters, it was gone. It had to be redrawn, and then people basically, you know, could get blacklisted or fired based upon their political leanings.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO, and we're talking this week with J.E. Smythe. She's the author of Nobody's Girl Friday, The Women Who Ran Hollywood. In the late 1940s, the Supreme Court decided that the Hollywood studios were in fact monopolies, and in a consent decree, the studios agreed to sell off their theaters, which greatly reduced their income.
So the blacklist, maybe even more than the consent decree or the onslaught of television, the blacklist really helped destroy the studio system as much as anything else.
It cleaned it out. I mean, there were a lot of, I think, women in the industry who had really fought hard for 15, 20 years to get to the top, and they were tired. And it was almost like you, with Virginia Van Opp, where she gets to the very top of her profession, she's, you know, overseeing all sorts of producers at Columbia. She is the top producer there. And it just gets to be too much for her. I think the blacklist was one additional thing that destroyed a lot of careers of people who were on the left, but it also, I think, was a moment for a lot of people who were even Republicans like Van Opp or Bobby McLean, where they thought, you know, I've really put in enough time and now it's time to shift gears and not be as present in the industry. And I think that even though a lot of these women were really great about mentoring younger women in the business, trying to help them up the ladder as others had done for them years before, that because of the way the production models were changing in the 1950s, more towards independent productions, that these women got shafted. They were marginalized and cut out of new job opportunities. And so, yes, there was a political dimension, but it had a lot to do with the demise of the studio system itself. The system was great for women. It was, you know, it was much more collaborative. There was much less of an emphasis on director-based auteurism. That was something that was really invented in the universities and by a bunch of film critics in France, and it caught on in the United States, unfortunately, and we're still living with it. But, you know, there was much more of a sense of people working together on a particular film. And in the past, I think there have been a lot of great film historians who've looked at men like Daryl Zanuck or David O. Selznick. I think of Tom Schatz and, you know, Mel Gusow's wonderful biography of Daryl Zanuck, Don't Say Yes Until I Finish Talking. And you do get a wonderful sense of these men being able to create styles for whole studios based upon their personal taste. And they really were fantastic. Zanuck was a fantastic writer as well, too. I'm less convinced about Selznick. But, you know, they were great. But at the same time, when I learned more about Barbara McLean's relationship with Zanuck, I realized how much gets lost when you just hear from one voice. So Gusow was just really interviewing Zanuck and all the male cronies, the yes men around him. You go back and you look into the archives and you find out that Barbara McLean was involved in script meetings. This is something you don't expect an editor to be doing. But even later on, when she was on set, she wasn't just confined to an editing room. Her colleagues weren't like that either. They would be on set with the director, and they'd be watching everything roll. And if they thought, for example, that the scene hadn't been handled well, they'd say, you know, you really need to do another protection shot. That wasn't good for me. Do something else, or cut in some more close-ups. I need some more close-ups here. And there are these wonderful stories of, in some cases, where the directors had just gone off to, I don't know, they thought the picture was finished. They went off to get drunk or to go on vacation or onto another production. That these editing women just did the close-ups themselves, you know?
Oh, they would shoot it themselves.
Yeah. Wow.
Interesting. So why did you, do you think women were such good editors?
Well, there's this theory. It's really an unpleasant theory that I read about once. I was reading some book about editing, and they said the theory was that women were good at editing because it was like sewing.
Oh, nice.
And I'm sorry if your program doesn't take four-letter words, but it's a lot of horseshit, really. It wasn't that. I mean, obviously, a lot of times women are script girls or they're continuity girls, you know, because they can keep all the details together and they're good at details. This is another theory about women with producing, that they're good at the money, they're good at the bottom line, they're good at details and holding everything together. But I don't think it was that. I mean, with Bobby and with a lot of her colleagues, I think Margaret Booth especially, I mean, she was really a fantastic editor, that there was the sense that editing was an art form. And I think editing is very often, it's overlooked, but there's something about it that distinguishes it among all arts. It's the one art that you can't have really in theater or, you know, in...
It's unique in about film.
In literature or in sculpture, what any kind of art, the only real art that is authentic to cinema and is the singular art is editing. And Bobby was trained from when she was a young girl by her father, but then she took it and ran with it. And she could feel this sense of rhythm in the images. And she had a musical training as well too. So many of these women were trained from the time they were, you know, little girls, you know, they learned music as well. And there was a synergy between the sense of music and imagery and the cutting. And it had nothing whatsoever to do with sewing. Like, what is this? You're trying to put a template, you know, so that you get a perfectly made, you know, piece of clothing that can be duplicated endlessly. Not at all. This was about something that was intensely unique. And I don't know. I mean, in looking at it and looking at the way they tried to think about editing, I mean, Anne Bauschens wrote a wonderful, what is it now? I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Put it down. Put it down.
She loves
it. Okay. Well, there's this. There's this wonderful book that came out in 1937. And Nancy Naumburg, who was she's a really interesting woman. She look her up. She edited it, and the chapter on editing was done by Anne Bauschens. So it was one of the very few chapters where the woman actually got to write about her art. You know. And Anne Bauschens was wonderful and said she sort of broke down what editing was, that there were several different kinds of cuts that you could have. And this was, she rationalized them and she went through, you know, how you would do it and so forth. But there was this sense of rhythm that you got from an awareness of imagery and it flowing in time with music. And music and film editing had some kind of complementary power and synergy. And this is what she and her colleagues understood so well. And there was a way, to a certain extent, I mean, Bobby Wood wrote about, or she talked at length about how she would have several different dozen takes of a particular scene, and she would just know instinctively how to put it together. And there were cases when early in her career where she talked about how she would be editing a sequence and she wouldn't have the score because Alfred Newman or whoever was doing it wouldn't have gotten around to composing it. And so she had her own musical store with her, her library, she called it. And so she would do the score herself, you know, and edit everything with music, a silent film. So you're the silent film fan. So here she goes. So she would always see her films as silent and she would put everything together with her own musical accompaniment. It used to piss off Alfred Newman no end. But Zanuck loved it because he was just like, this is exactly the rhythm I want. She's got the rhythm. You do the score to her rhythm. So she felt it. She felt the pulse of that film. And she could, and editors, film editors like, you know, Booth or Anne Bauschens or McLean, they could feel this pulse and this rhythm on the set. And they would hear it in the rhythm of the actors speaking. And, you know, there are these wonderful interviews where editing women would talk about how they would sit in on rehearsals and they would hear the pulse in the dialogue, in the connections between the actors as they are reading out the script. And that's why I think you see so many film production documents where you actually have the editor involved at an early stage in the script development, that there's this sense of, ah, we need somebody who grasps this connection. And I think it's really wonderful. McCall, Mary McCall loved editors as well too. She grew up with actors. She adored Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney. She had known them in New York, and she was very close with members of the Screen Actors Guild. There was a kind of deep bond between the two guilds, and they did a lot of cross guild benefits in Hollywood together. And there was a great community between them, but also with editors. And she really reached out with them and said, you know, we need to have these meetings where editors and writers are talking together, because it's really there that the creativity flourishes. It's not necessarily directors who, you know, are creating this vision. I mean, we're the ones who are writing it, and actors will say the most important, they still say it, the most important thing is the script. That's all I need. And she knew that. And in order to get the best film, she felt there had to be a deeper link between screen editors, film editors, and writers, that that was where the real creativity happened in Hollywood. And it was because they had all of these guilds and unions, very many of them were overseen by women. Everything from, you know, publicity and journalism to librarians, archivists, you know, editors and writers, and they would meet and they would talk, and there, and you had these connections and you had these benefits. And I think that's something that today's Hollywood will find really hard to imagine, but will be very nostalgic for when they read about it, that there was this, there was the Motion Picture Relief Fund, there was the Community Chess, there were all kinds of charitable organizations that all played polo together at the Riviera Country Club. There was this real community. And I mean, even if you hated these producers when you were at work during the week, you could still meet them for sport and talk with them. And there was a sense that Hollywood was not just the job. You were not completely divorced from everything. You had a kind of family. And of course, there were lots of executive secretaries and women who were involved in the administration of studios on a ground day-to-day level, who were supervising these sort of family aspects of studio life. And it was funny, because if you talk with people who are in the business now, they were just like, oh my God, I wish I could have existed in that time, where you actually had the sense of community, where you actually had work, where you knew where your next job was coming from, but you also had the sense of community. And part of that, I think, was really fostered by a lot of the women who were in the business. And of course, when the studio system falls apart, that community goes too. You know, so I mean, Ida Koverman's another woman who appears in the book a bit, and she's another one of these great figures who was able to see that, you know, you have more power, you know, really across the board in all kinds of different areas of the business. So, you know, she was, there were schools, obviously, at the studios, and, you know, you had talent supervision and so forth, and you had the commissary where everybody would meet, and there were all sorts of organizations. There were studio newsletters, you know, which she edited, and she'd ask like McCall or other women to write articles for this or that. And you know, you had base softball games, the women would meet for softball games, tennis, you know, whatever, and they would be reported, you know, career highs, promotions. When, you know, Margaret Booth was promoted to, you know, supervising editor, they had a little note there. So, I mean, it was all part of a different kind of studio life that, and I was reading about it and I just loved it. And I thought, if only the people in the business could feel that way now.
So they were a part of a factory that was manufacturing something, but the thing that they were manufacturing was art. So it's interesting that it's the meeting of art and commerce in the motion picture industry.
A factory, yes, but how many well, I suppose Henry Ford did have like facilities for his workers to rest that, you know, and even Mary McCall's father at New York Life, he was in charge of creating, you know, holiday resorts or whatever for employees who were recovering from illnesses or whatever. So yeah, you did at the corporate level in America back in the 20s, 30s and 40s, you did have these little nice amenities in a kind of studio factory existence. But I think it was more than that. And I mean, they had this wonderful moment, thanks to Ned Comstock, when he was just like, hey, I found an MGM telephone book for you, Jennifer. Merry Christmas. And I was like, oh, great. Sort of looking at it on Christmas Day. And they had all the phone numbers of everybody. And I was looking at over half of the numbers were for women. But it was like, you know, the whole editing room, you had the writers, you had the woman who was in charge of transport at the studio, casting, animal training, you know, it goes on and on, the school, on and on and on and on. And it was just insane. I was reading this and I was thinking, well, anybody who said that the studios were wholly masculine and there were only two jobs that women could do in Hollywood, it was, you know, be glamorous, stand still and be stupid, you know, basically what Hedy Lamarr said about being an actress and being a secretary, where all you basically did was, you know, fetch coffee and, you know, bend over to get pinched every now and then by your boss. I mean, this was the extent of what women were supposed to have done in the business. Well, let's look at a phone book and you can tell me if that story really, you know, still has some credibility. It doesn't.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're talking this week with J.E. Smythe. She's the film historian who is the author of Nobody's Girl Friday, The Women Who Ran Hollywood.
You do talk about Betty Davis, who was, of course, in front of the camera.
And behind too.
Behind the camera too, right. So why Betty Davis, you know, as opposed, why give her sort of special attention in your book? Because there's so many actresses of that era, but what did Betty Davis do that is different?
Well, again, I think it has to do with a sense of community. And I mean, Olivia de Havilland, she's been important in my career for a long time. We corresponded at the beginning of my career when I started to write about historical films, and I wanted to know about, you know, what it was like on the set of Gone with the Wind and her relationship with Walter Plunkett, who designed her costumes and so forth. She was wonderful. But there's been so much interest, you know, obviously in her because of her recent death. And you know, there have been journalists who said that she was the one who saved actors by ending the slavery of the 7-year contract and so forth. And I deliberately contrasted the two of them because I think that Davis's career is interesting in that she played by the rules. I mean, she fought and she was rebellious and she was on suspension, just like James Cagney as well too. Most of the actors at Warner Brothers were always on suspension, and they used to have little games where they would say, well, who's been suspended for longer, you know, and this kind of thing, that kind of one-upmanship. And she, after her court case, when they ruled against her, you know, she had tried to break her contract, go to England and work there, and Warner's hauled her back. She played by the rules, and she was, to a certain extent, a good girl, but she worked for the community. She worked for the Motion Picture Relief Fund. She worked for the Screen Actors Guild. She did cross benefits. She wrote articles for the joint magazine between the Screenwriters Guild and the Screen Actors Guild. She helped younger talent along, regardless of whether they were black or white. She was influential in, you know, fostering a number of actors' careers over the years. But she also, for a while, she took the presidency of the Academy. It was just for a few months. But she was very much invested in doing things for women and for herself by playing within the system. And it worked to a certain extent. She did become a producer on one of her own films. She did become the most highly paid actress. Even after 1945, she was still making more than the top male stars of that era. She also, later in life, when everybody was bashing the Hollywood studio system, she gave it its due. And she said, you know, I fought like hell with Jack Warner. And maybe I could have had more chances in a different kind of world. But the system was pretty good for women. And it enabled me to rise. And it was a period in which women did have a great deal of power. And the films themselves, I mean, she focused not just on the production, but on the films, the scripts and the roles. She said it was this, you know, a cinema for women. Most of her great hits were melodramas or whatever, which were focused the women's film. But again, you know, across the board, she said, it's not something that should be denigrated or rendered as, you know, as a kind of niche genre. But women and female audiences mattered to these moguls and to the audiences. It was a great period. And I think that when you look at somebody like de Havilland, she had a very antagonistic relationship toward the system. And I think that as well too with Katharine Hepburn, a lot of these women weren't very good with working with other women. And for Bette Davis, what distinguished her, I think, from a lot of her colleagues is that she worked with women across the board, whether they were writers or producers, journalists, casting directors, other actors or whatever, in spite of the fact that, you know, in the media these days, all they want to focus on is her feud with Joan Crawford and what a bitch she was later in life. I mean, again, that's part and parcel of this myth that we have about the system, that women were just pretty objects. And the only thing they could do when they were together was fight, because women are basically bitches. And that's part of it. So if you want to look for the great art in the studio system, oh, don't look at Bette Davis, don't look at Dorothy Arzner, whatever, but look at the great director auteurs. And yeah.
That whole Bette Davis, Joan Crawford thing just ignores the fact that she hated Miriam Hopkins more than she hated Joan Crawford.
I know, but in a way, there was a point where they got along quite well, because I found when I was looking in the archives that when Bette Davis couldn't make a SAG meeting, she asked Miriam to take her proxy.
Oh.
So they were good enough friends at one point for Miriam Hopkins to vote for Bette Davis at one of the guild meetings. So at some point they did get along very well. And Miriam Hopkins as well too. She was very political and working for the guild in the 1930s. And I think that particularly during the Roosevelt years, there was a great energy in Hollywood among Hollywood's women to really transform the industry and keep it a place for women as it had been in the 1920s, and to really maintain it as a kind of bastion for equality, in spite of the fact that there were so many horrific cases of women being abused in the system and sexually harassed. There was another side to it as well too, and I can't illustrate it any differently than talking about Harry Cohn. Now Harry Cohn, I think we were talking about your students. If they might know him from anywhere, you'd probably tell him that he was the model for that horrible producer in The Godfather. I mean, that's generally how we think of him now. I mean, he died in the late 1950s, and he sort of passed into obscurity, with the exception of Bob Thomas's great biography. And he's seen these days, particularly in the Me Too era, as a
Oh, he would never have survived the Me Too era.
As a sexual harasser par excellence, you know, that this guy really would, you know, could try to seduce just about anyone. But I think in contrast to somebody like Harvey Weinstein, that he would take no for an answer as long as you said it forcefully enough. And Mary McCall was actually working at Columbia. She hated working at Warner Brothers because it was a super macho studio, and she got paid less than half of that, what the men were getting. Dalton Trumbo actually worked there around the same time, and they were fired very nearly at the same time at Warner Brothers. And both of them found a home in Columbia. But McCall, because she was working with Dorothy Arzner on Craig's Wife, and Viola Lawrence, the chief editor at Columbia, was also working on that project together. It's a great film. But McCall and Cohn got along great. I mean, she was interviewed later in the 1970s saying, did you ever witness any cases of sexual harassment? Did he ever sexually harass you or whatever? And she said, well, you know, if I went through my entire career without being chased around a desk, I'd feel a little sad. But she said, no, you know, we got along fine. You know, he was the type of person who would sock you in the jaw, but he'd never knife you in the back. And she said that was Louis B. Mayer. That was the type of guy he was. But the Cohn was straight with you, and that he liked somebody who would talk back to him, and that he had great respect for women. And he hired a number of female screenwriters in the 1930s and 40s. His chief editor, as I said, By Lawrence, was a woman. And of course, he promoted Virginia Van Upp over all other producers at his studio in the late 1940s, and she had worked there for years. And he had a number of other women who were working as producers in the 40s too. He hired more women as producers in his own studio than all the other studio heads combined. And I suppose some cynics might say, oh, it was probably because he wanted to have more women around that he could chase, you know. But what has remained in their memoirs and, you know, in interviews and so forth, is that he would respect women for the brains that they had. And it's kind of unfortunate that of all the studio heads, he's the one who has the worst reputation as far as sexual harassment goes these days. But it really isn't warranted when you look at the way he treated women in his own studio, that they were everywhere at all levels of production. And she said, and McCall said that she'd always choose an honest rogue over a hypocrite. And Cohn was the honest rogue and Louis B. Mayer the hypocrite.
So now you told me you're working on a book about Mary C. McCall Jr., a biography.
Yes, I am. I'm writing her biography. I'm nearing the end. And she's fascinating, but it's just, as you say, it's really unusual that a woman so powerful could have disappeared so completely from film history. I mean, this is what really shocks me. You know, I was lucky a couple of years ago, Mary's two daughters, one of them is Sheila Benson, the former LA Times film critic. The other's Mary David Shiner, who's a television writer in the 1970s. They both her children turned out wonderful. She had four of them and still managed this career. I don't know how she did it. But we were showing Craig's wife to the members of the Writers Guild, at a special screening. And so many of them came up afterward to me and they said, I had no idea that she was our president and that she was elected in 1942. I had no idea. And she was elected three times. Nobody ever told me, where was this woman? Why has this happened? And that's the thing. And I mean, a few years ago, Victoria Riskin was honored with the Valentine Davies Award, which McCall was the first recipient to get it. It was actually created specifically for her. And it's like one of the most famous awards that you can get from the Guild for service to writers. And there was some coverage of this award, and they said that Riskin was the first female president of the Guild. And this was a press release from the Screenwriters Guild, the Writers Guild of America West. So even they had forgotten her.
They didn't know.
They had forgotten her utterly. And it's incredible when you think that this is the woman who basically wrote the writer's contract. She is the reason, along with a handful of other men, including Charles Brackett, who was her dear friend, who got this passed, who negotiated with the producers and were able to make a kind of coalition across the board, the left and right in the Guild, to get this passed. She held them together and got them pay rises during the war when, you know, there was a lot of opposition to that. Credit arbitration, you know, compensation, the end to speculative writing and abuses by producers. She was very upfront about that, jobs for men and women. And, you know, and she sacrificed her career for another writer. She didn't side with him politically. They weren't friends, but he was a writer. And I think it was a friend of hers who used to work with Sonia Levine at Fox, Bill Ludwig. He said, you know, Mary was for all writers. If you were a writer, she loved you and she would do anything for you. And there was just nobody like her. And I think that it's just unfortunate that she has vanished. She wrote some of the most respected and popular films of that era. Now, when we think about writers getting percentage deals or people who aren't directors or producers getting percentage deals, I mean, it's a kind of, you know, happens all the time. But writers didn't really get it that often. And when she made quite a great deal in 1943 for Fox, writing The Sullivans, the story of the brothers who all died in the Second World War together on the same vessel. It was done independently and she wrote all the scripts, but she got, you know, 15% of the gross and had a special deal with that. And does she keep it all to herself? You know, does she not tell anybody and use it to build her nest in Hollywood to go on to greater and greater things? No. She, you know, writes a long article in The Screenwriter where she talks about every detail about how you do this and how younger writers can get this too. And she's very upfront about it. You know, when the film doesn't sell particularly well in certain areas because it seems too depressing, she admits that. And she talks about, well, perhaps the only reason I got the deal was because I was president of the guild, and maybe this is one of the deciding factors why I would get it rather than another writer. She was very frank, very honest, and she wanted all writers to succeed.
I look forward to reading that book. And
this book is called Nobody's Girl Friday, The Women Who Ran Hollywood, and the author, my guest, J.E. Smythe. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.